The innocence of children. It's something that adults worldwide have lost. Some long for the innocence of their childhood, while others strive to imitate it by surrounding themselves with what made them happy as children. However, there are some that find a child's innocence raw, pure, and powerful. Innocence is a quality that is untainted by the corruption of mankind. In essence, the innocence of a child is humanity in its purest form. On an unusually rainy November night in Tivoli Gardens, a slender figure holding a bag in each lanky arm made its way out of an apartment building. This figure was never heard or seen by anyone, despite the fact the figure must have been in the building for several hours throughout the night. The following morning, a bright, sunny day, Bodrick and Zakiya Lewis, wondering why their children hadn't gotten up for breakfast, went to check on them in their bedrooms. What they found in each room sent a silent fear through Zakiya's body and got Bodrick to drop to his knees in terror. In both rooms, the Lewis's children laid uncovered on their beds, their skins peeled off from head to toe. I'm Agent Kai, and I've decided to make my reports for Lives in the form of a podcast. My hope is that you, dear listener, will discover the truth of this world and open your eyes to it. I had spent a week catching up on my reading and lounging around the beaches in Ocho Rios, one of my favorite destinations to unwind, when Cameron reached out to inform me of what our intelligencer in Kingston had discovered. A series of child mutilations that was spreading fear throughout the area. The residents, Cameron told me, were saying this was the work of Obia, while others blamed the local crime bosses. Whatever was causing this atrocity, I thought, it had to stop. That same day, I rented a Toyota Fielder, hopped onto Highway 2000, and made my way toward Tivoli Gardens. The building where the Lewis family lived was closed off with caution tape. Only residents could enter the apartment complex, and those walking inside were questioned by the police officers standing guard. One of them, a big burly man whose muscles looked like they were about to rip through his combat fatigues, was disgruntled. His disdained face watched the crowd before him. It was a large gathering of people from the neighborhood, some talking about duppies walking the earth, while others aimed their anger and fear at the police about doing nothing to protect the children. I made my way through this crowd as I surveyed the area with a cautious eye. It was a four-story building that housed several families with children, but only the Lewis children were targeted. Was that on purpose, or were they the first victims of the figure that took their skin? Around the entrance, next to the armed officers were reporters. One of them, a lean man, was speaking to Zakiya Lewis. I recognized her from the profile pictures Cameron sent to me earlier in Ocho Rios. Their body language suggested familiarity with each other. On my way here, an hour and some changes worth of time, I had our Lyles tech expert, Percy Blade, work on my Legends credentials throughout the internet. As far as anyone was concerned, I was Rick Salvage, a folklore writer working on a new book of Jamaican folklore. A quick or detailed Google search would show that Rick Salvage had written about Colombian, Native, African, German, and Scandinavian folklore. These books could be purchased on ThriftBooks or Amazon. However, they were backordered indefinitely. Therefore, I tried my luck at gaining access into the building to speak to the Lewis family, but the armed police officers told me to leave, despite my pleas and experience in supernatural things. When I repeated myself, saying that I could perhaps help the Lewis family, one of the officers, the disgruntled burly one, aimed their rifle at me and warned that if I didn't leave, I would regret it. My arms raised in the air, I took a few steps back. The lean man, wearing a bulletproof vest that read "Press," approached me. "What is wrong with you?" he said. "Nothing. I was just trying to see if I could help the Lewis family." He gave me a hard look.
"And how you know the Lewis family?"
"I don't," I said. "But I wondered if perhaps I could bring them some comfort. You see, I'm a folklore writer, and I just wanted to ease their minds. I hear a lot of people talking about Obia out here. That can't be easy for the Lewis family. The man nodded.
Rick Savage, I looked you up. Now how do you expect to help that family?
Well, I've come across things during my research in the past. Enough to know that sometimes dark forces step out of the shadows to harm the living. And if that were the case here, I could help the family gain justice for their children. The lean man remained silent for a moment, his left hand rubbing his grizzled chin.
All right, Siri, he said. Tell you what, you come with me now, and we see if you're real.
Bless, I said.
The name's Edward Lindo, Jamaica Observer. Come on, let's go.
I followed Edward to the building's entrance. The burly officer was quick to get in front of us. However, when Edward showed the officer his press credentials, the big man moved out of the way, much to his chagrin.
Them boss is my brethren, Edward said, as we walked along the open hallway towards Lewis' apartment.
That's it, he turned to me.
Listen, Sari, you best be real.
The Lewis family were seated in the living room. Bodrick held Zakiya in his arms as she sobbed into his chest. She held a one-eyed teddy bear in one hand and a plush zebra in the other. Edward told me to wait in the foyer while he sauntered over to the grieving parents. It was Bodrick who he spoke to, letting him know my presence. The solemn-faced man glanced up at me. That's when Edward made a small gesture with his head. I introduced myself to the torn-up parents and gave them my sincerest condolences.
No offense, Bodrick said with an American accent. But how can you help us? Babylon can't do shit. What can you do?
You're right, the police can't do anything, I said. But I'm not the police. I can find out what happened to your children. Zakiya, who'd been sobbing this whole time, raised her head out of her husband's chest and looked at me.
You cannot help we, mister. We baby's dead. We tired of speaking to people.
I understand, Mrs. Lewis, I said. But if what happened to your children is what I fear, then we're going to need to find the monster responsible. If not, the souls of your children will forever be damned. Zakiya burst into tears.
What the hell is the matter with you? Bodrick said. And you, Edward, why would you bring this man to us?
Bodrick, we know what happened to your kids is unnatural, Edward said. This could be Obia, and this man here could help.
Bodrick scoffed.
Don't give me that supernatural bullshit. What happened to my kids is that a psycho came in here, drugged them, and took their skin.
Whether a psychopath or a supernatural being, I said, wouldn't you want your children's killer caught?
Listen, Babylon is trying, so what's the harm in Rick trying too? I want you and your weird friend here to leave my home.
No, Bodrick,
Zakiya said, sobbing.
Me fear this man is right.
Zakiya had excused herself to the bathroom while Edward made a fresh pot of coffee. And not just any coffee, Jamaica Blue Mountain coffee, the best coffee in the world in my opinion. When Zakiya returned, we all took a seat in the living room. Zakiya looked at Edward for a moment and both exchanged nods.
Zakiya's me sister, Rick, Edward said, and we mother used to tell we stories.
Edward began his story by telling us about his mother, a hard-working woman who had seen more than she should have. Before she fell in love and had children, Irie was a young woman who enjoyed exploring the countryside. One evening, Irie lost track of time taking pictures of the local wildlife.
She enjoyed taking them pictures, Edward said. She wanted to start a scrapbook of animals, but that night all those photos would be lost.
Irie, caught in a torrential downpour, ran as fast as she could down a dark road. Kenan, her boyfriend at the time, was supposed to pick her up and drive her back into Kingston, but he never showed up. This wasn't the first time he'd done this to her. The first time, Kenan had said he got caught in traffic and was then pulled over by the police. This turned out to be a lie. He was caught in traffic, but only because he decided to hang out with his friends and get high, nearly forgetting his responsibility to Irie. The second time, he said his car had a flat tire. Later, he confessed that he was drunk and wanted to wait until he sobered up before driving. Irie was furious then, and was beyond furious now. She had also made up her mind to dump his lying sack of bones the instant she saw him in town. As she walked down this long stretch of dark road, her anger keeping her company, she saw something ahead of her that chilled her bones. It was Keenan's car, abandoned. Irie inspected the car and found the keys were still in the ignition. She shouted Keenan's name in the pouring rain, but didn't receive any response. Half expecting to see the rolling cough appear before her, Irie started for the car to drive back into town to inform the police when she saw it from the corner of her eye, the small red house. Funny, she didn't remember seeing a red house when she drove out earlier in the day with Keenan. Against her better judgment, Irie decided to walk over to the house to see if Keenan was inside. Slowly, Irie approached the red house and peered into one of its windows. First, she noticed a round table where a leather-bound book written by the Lawrence, a book, dear listener, that contains supernatural arts such as magic and divination, a book that is illegal in Jamaica, rested on the table. Then, Irie focused her attention to the center of the living room, where she saw a man moving around. On the floor, stripped of his clothes, was Keenan. Irie didn't know what to do. She was frozen. All she could do was watch as this man, whose face she never saw except for his pale blue hands, as he took a sharp knife and started skinning Keenan. Irie covered her mouth with her hand as she heard Keenan cry out in agony.
"We might have told we that Keenan kept his eyes upon her the whole time," Edward said. "Oh, we poor mother, all alone. Ugh, ratted."
Irie nearly fell as she backed away from the red house. Once she was a few feet out and under the cover of loud thunder, she ran back to the car and drove as fast as she could back to Kingston.
"We might have was convinced that Keenan," Edward said, "was turned into a doppy that night, and that he would come for her one day," Zakiah said. "But it wasn't her he come for. It was me babies."
"Okay, that is enough story time," Bodrick said. "This is crazy. No ghosts from beyond the grave came for our children."
"You might be right, Mr. Lewis," I said. "But if it's all the same, may I inspect your children's bedroom?"
"If it'll get you to leave sooner, be my guest."
The children's room was small, barely enough space for the two twin beds that it contained. Whoever or whatever flayed these innocent children didn't have much legroom to work with. While Edward and Bodrick argued in the living room about allowing me to help out, I took out a small spray bottle, no bigger than those cologne samples given out in malls, called Spellcast, and sprayed its contents on the floor and bed and headboards. The purpose of this spellcast is not to cast spells, dear listener, but rather to detect if any magic or any kind of that sort was involved. If so, the spellcast spray would reveal a chalky residue that would have been left behind if a magical being were present. And just as I thought, the spray revealed the chalky residue all over the beds, headboards, and floor. Bodrick was wrong on this one. It wasn't a human psychopath at work here. It was something else, perhaps a duppy, or worse, an Obia man. A duppy, dear listener, is a restless spirit. There are some that are good, such as the spirit of a deceased loved one who may help you when you are in need of their help. However, there are bad duppies that can cause a lot of harm, especially those who are controlled by an Obia man, a witch who practices the dark arts. To flay young children was unspeakable. There was only one reason I could think of as to why a witch would do this. Innocence. Or rather, the essence of innocence. This can give the user many abilities such as maintaining their youth or increasing their power. You see, innocence, when it comes to thaumaturgical discussion, lies within the soul of young children. Therefore, hypothetically speaking, if a being like a witch, specifically a reckless and wild witch, wanted to extract innocence, they would need to extract a child's soul. However, such a spell would be too great to cast without a major sacrifice. Instead, innocence could be extracted using the skin of a young child without an exchange. The only downfall to this method is that the thaumaturgical user would have to skin several children in order to concoct whatever spell they desired. And whatever spell they desired, if using children's skin, was going to be a powerful one. This told me that the Obia man at work here would have to strike again, tonight. And because these dark art practitioners were partial to counting, they would choose to skin the children in the apartment that followed the first. When I rejoined the others in the living room, I asked Bodrick if there were any more children, specifically those around the ages of newborn to 10 years old, in the nearby apartment complex. He didn't know, but Zakiya did. She told me that two apartments down was a Davis family, who brought home a newly born baby girl a fortnight ago. I asked Zakiya if she could be so kind as to introduce me to the Davis family. With teary eyes, she nodded. That night, after speaking with the Davis family, and with Zakiya's and Edward's help, we managed to convince the Davis family to allow me to stay in their child's room until the break of dawn. Of course, since the Davis family knew Edward and Zakiya well, their only request was that Edward stay with me in the room. A reasonable request.
"Was it necessary to douse we with this nasty spray?" Edward said. "We smell like baby vomit."
"If we want to hide our scent from the duppy making its way over here," I said, smiling, "then yes, it is necessary."
"Rotted," Edward said, glancing over at the crib. "You think this would really work?"
"Only time will tell." Edward and I waited in the silence of the night for hours. It wasn't until 2 a.m, when Edward was asleep, that I noticed a shadow hovering over the room's window. Its long nails scratched along the window pane for several minutes before opening it. The shadow glided into the room. It was tall, about 6 feet in height, hunched back with long, lanky limbs that it dragged on the ground. It reeked of death and decay. I watched it as it moved toward the empty bed, passing through silver slivers of moonlight that revealed its stitched-up skin. Modern-day Prometheus, courtesy of a wild Obia man. I stayed in the dark, motionless, and just watched as the duppy pulled the covers off the bed to reveal a giant stuffed crocodile in the Davis' child's stead. It tipped its head to the side before sniffing the air. Then, like an owl, it rotated its head 130 degrees. That's when I pulled out the Lumen Stunner, a taser-shaped device that injected an electric wave of bioluminescent dust. Basically, this device stunned its victim and coated them with glowing dust that was invisible to the naked eye, but radiant when using infrared. When the duppy made its way toward me, I thumbed down the Lumen Stunner, but the creature slid to the side, avoiding the hit.
"What that?"
Edward said, waking up.
"What happening?"
The duppy let out a high-pitched scream. "Edward, remain still!"
"Oh shit, no, forget this!"
Edward got up and started for the door, but the duppy swung its long arm and tossed Edward across the room. I got up and took a second shot and missed. The duppy, despite its size, was quite agile. Unleashing another roar, it swung its arms again, this time digging its razor-sharp claws into my chest and tossed me from one end of the room to the other. I could feel blood dripping down my chest and abdomen. The duppy had its large insect eyes set on me. I waited until it made its move. It lunged at me. In that moment, I shot the duppy with the Lumen Stunner. This caused the wretched being to screech once again, as the electricity exploded into dust, covering every square inch of the duppy's hacked body. Then, the creature jumped out the window in the blink of an eye. Groaning, I made my way over to Edward and checked his pulse. He was still alive. A bit bruised and battered, but alive. The next morning, after assuring the Davis family, who heard the roar of the duppy during the night, that they were safe now, Edward and I returned to Zakiya's apartment. Much to my relief, Zakiya was studying to become a nurse and was able to stitch up my wounds. She also provided me with a clean shirt, despite Bodrick's initial reluctance. I thanked Zakiya.
"So,
What the hell made that noise last night?
Bodrick said. It scared the shit out of Z and me.
It scared ya,
Edward said, icing his bruised arm.
Imagine being in a da room with that thing.
It was a duppy, I said. An unusual one. This duppy isn't a restless spirit. It seems to be a hodgepodge of body parts hacked together like Frankenstein's monster.
The Orb Yaman, Zakiya said. The one who killed Kinan.
That's a possibility. I stood up and winced. Either way, it must be stopped.
And where you going? Zakiya said. Your wound's still fresh.
That duppy's master is furious, no doubt. He will send more tonight for all the children in this apartment complex. I must stop him before this happens.
Bodrick scoffed.
Well, good going, Rambo. You pissed it off and now let it go free.
How about you shut up, Edward said. At least Rick is doing something. You know, see Babylon making a move.
You know what, Edward?
Enough. You too, stay quiet,
Zakiya said.
How will you find the duppy, Mr. Rick?
I tagged it with a tracker of sorts. I walked up to Zakiya. I promise you, Mrs. Lewis, that I will find the Obia man responsible for your children's murder, and I will end his existence.
You make him suffer the way me children suffered.
I glanced at Zakiya's dark brown eyes and nodded. After having a cup of coffee, I set out to track the duppy using a pair of sunglasses that were designed to detect the bioluminescent dust. Edward, despite my warnings, decided to join me on my hunt. We took my rental and drove from Tevoli Gardens all the way to the southern tip of Kingston. From here, the duppy's tracks led us to the Jamaica Customs Agency, where it dove into the ocean and swam out to sea. It was impressive how much ground that duppy could cover over a single night.
Rotted, Edward said. What are we going to do now?
We grab a boat, Edward. Thanks to our Lyos Intelligencer, Edward and I were able to get our hands on a Nortec 390 sport speedboat. We departed from Port Royal out into the glimmering blue ocean around noon. The dust left a trail like an oil spill on the surface of the water, making it easy for me to track its movements. We hopped over wave after wave, passing up Lime Cay and Maiden Cay, and then ocean. For a while, it seemed like the duppy gave us the runaround, seeing as there was nothing but ocean all around us. But once we were about 50 miles south of Maiden Cay, an island appeared on the horizon, despite its absence on the boat's radar and digital map. From the distance, the island resembled a large crocodile's skull. I brought the boat to a complete stop when we were a few miles off the island shore. Using the binocular lens on my sunglasses, a feature activated by pressing a small button on the right side of the lens frame, I examined the shore. Deserted. However, the dust trail led into the jungle that made up the interior of the small island. As the waves rocked us back and forth, Edward realized the shape of the island.
No way, Edward said. That cool island. Me heard stories of this place.
Edward went on to say that Ghoul Island was a place that shouldn't exist. Back in the 17th century, pirates that sailed through the Caribbean around this part claimed to have come across an island that resembled a crocodile's head, where pirates would dismount and never return to their ships. It was said, Edward claimed, that late at night, when the seas were calm, a person sailing close to the island could hear the agonizing screams of past pirates still trapped on that godforsaken rock. But then again, if you were sailing close to the island, if you could see it, it meant the island had seen you and would drag you into its bowels.
That a bad place, Edward said. We shouldn't be going there.
I agree, I said. But I made a promise to your sister, and I intend on keeping it. I pulled out a scuba diving suit with a tank and all from one of the boat's storage compartments that doubled as a couch. I understand if you don't want to go. Take the Nortec back to the mainland. I'll swim out to the island and see what I can do.
You're serious? We can't let you do that alone.
Edward peered out at Ghoul Island.
Have Z and others say me let you go alone to die?
He shook his head.
Not going to happen, Siri. Me I gotta go with you.
This will be dangerous, Edward, I said. The risk of death is great. Understand that. And if you're okay with it, then let's be on our way.
Yeah, man. We always wanted to go to a haunted island. Be cool with it.
I increased the boat's throttle and started for Ghoul Island. The first thing we noticed when we stepped on the island and made our way into the jungle was the silence. There wasn't a bird or insect making any noise, just dead silence that pierced one's ears. The farther in we went, the darker it became as the trees' canopies blocked out the sun. After about an hour of trekking through the dense jungle, Edward and I came to a clearing. In front of us stood a 200-foot temple covered in vines and thick tree roots. The air that lingered here was stale and smelled pungent and acidy, the smell of blood. Without wasting breath, Edward and I climbed the steep, nearly vertical stone stairs that ran the height of the pyramid. On several steps, we noticed spots of dried blood and, every now and then, the occasional chunk of dried human flesh. When we reached the top entrance, we were hit with a waft of putrid air that almost sent us tumbling back down the stairs. With our hands over our mouths, we marched into that dark opening. The pyramid's interior revealed a large chamber with a high ceiling containing a circular opening that let some sunlight inside. Hanging from the large rafters all around were upside-down bodies of victims. They were all skinned, so that the bodies were nothing more than muscle and other sinuous fibers. In the center was a large stone slab stained with blood. A sharp cackle reverberated throughout the pyramid.
You've come at a most convenient time. You both shall be sacrificed to my queen, and she and I shall wear your skins while we dance under the new sun.
I pulled out a small leather pouch filled with salt from the messenger bag I had slung over my shoulder and gave it to Edward. Take this, I said, and use it if a flare gets too close to you. We do all be a man watching us, I said. I'm sure he'll make an appearance once we're cornered. And sure enough, out of the shadows of the chamber appeared the flare we encountered last night in Davis's apartment.
What kind of duppy is that?
A modified kind, I said. Whoever this Obia man was, dear listener, he wasn't authentic. The creature he controlled was meant to appear as a duppy. However, the reality was that this creature was born of various human flesh. If I didn't know any better, I'd say this creature too was to be sacrificed to whoever this Obia man's queen was. As I examined the creature in more detail as it came toward us, I realized that the flesh it contained was young and taut, the flesh of the innocent. It lunged at us with amazing speed. In one fluid motion, the creature managed to swing its long arms and hit both Edward and myself, flinging us into the hanging cadavers. The moment we touched those sinewy bodies, they came to life and grabbed hold of us with a death grip.
Let the wind sing that the terrible Crookshank is all powerful.
A man wearing a cowl appeared from the shadows. He removed his large hood, revealing a large, pale blue face.
Today, you two shall be my final pound of flesh, Crookshank said. I will finally be able to be with my queen tonight.
He turned toward the creature.
Take a close look, Edward. My pet here is sporting the flesh of your niece and nephew.
No!
The creature swung its clawed finger at Edward's mouth and slashed his lips off, exposing his teeth. Edward screamed and writhed in pain.
And if you look really close, Crookshank said, you can see some of Kenan's skin too. Oh, so were the days of my ignorance. The flesh of the strong was not worth power. Only innocence is worth power. Should have seen that sooner. I should. Well, that matters is that I finally understand.
Crookshank turned to me.
You are a tabula rasa. My, this is fun. No peering into your soul, I see.
Whether Crookshank was telling the truth about having flayed Kenan all those years ago, or reading Edward like a book to psychologically torture him, I wasn't sure. But what I did know was that this hack enjoyed getting a reaction out of his victims. Therefore, I closed my mind to him by keeping my thoughts clear. Crookshank made a gesture with his hand. The creature then slashed me across the abdomen. I could feel blood running down my abdomen and legs. I focused my mind on the movement of the ocean, drifting away from the island out to the farthest reaches of sea. You see, dear listener, when being tortured occurs, pain, or the fear of pain, will break a person and make them submit to their torturer. However, Lyle's agents are trained to separate their minds from their bodies in order to prevent such a break. Of course, this means that the possibility of dying is great, for the torturer may end up inflicting more damage on the human frame than it can be withstood. In that moment, as the creature once again slashed at my chest from the opposite end this time, I was prepared to meet my death. A woman's voice.
Kare kashindara, karu kushanko, anata moshino. Watashi no yo!
The sound of the woman's voice was familiar. It brought me back to that pyramid, pain and all. I winced as the searing burn of the gashes on my abdomen radiated through every fiber of my being. The following conversation between Cruikshank and Tamamo no Mae took place in Japanese, dear listener. For your convenience, I have translated the conversation into English here.
My queen, Cruikshank said, I am honored you have finally made your appearance. I have been gathering innocence as a gift of marriage for you. Ever since I heard you broke free of your rocky prison, I doubled my efforts. Together, you and I will rule this world.
No, Cruikshank, Mae said. I rule this world. You are nothing but a maggot that I allow to live.
As your king, you shall now speak to me in such a manner. No, no.
You are no king, and I have no king. I am the queen. I am a goddess.
Cruikshank nodded.
Well, this is disappointing. He snapped his fingers. We shall see who bows to whom.
The creature used its own claws to rip itself open from its chest down to the nave. Cruikshank, a man no taller than 5 feet, jumped into the creature's insides and chanted something underneath his breath. Within minutes, Cruikshank and the creature fused into one being.
Pity, Cruikshank said. A powerful sorcerer such as yourself should have a strong king.
Mae laughed.
Men, always with the ego. That's what makes you weak, Cruikshank. Even now, in this monstrous form you believe gives you power, you're weak. Cruikshank rushed Mae, but he didn't get far. Mae, with the mere flip of her wrist, turned Cruikshank to stone. Then, she obliterated him out of existence. Mae turned to me. In the blink of an eye, she ripped the cadaver that held me in place to shreds.
You knew how to defeat him, didn't you? She said.
Painfully, I stood up.
Yeah. How?
Cruikshank fed off fear and anger and hurt, I said. All I had to do was show him no reaction. When he saw the torture wouldn't get me to fear him, he would then try something more drastic. Perhaps it would have been fusing himself with his creature. Whatever the case, once he pulled a move like that off, I would remain silent. His ego wouldn't allow him to kill me if I didn't fear him, which in turn would cause him to turn all the anger and hate and hurt he had inside himself on himself and commit suicide. Mae smiled.
Clever. But that may not have worked. You could have died. Or it could have worked, but he could have tortured you so much that you would have died of your own wounds.
I was ready to face death, I said. Ready to visit that unknown country.
You would have given your life to help a poor couple from an island. Why?
Because those who have been grossly wronged deserve justice in an otherwise unjust world. Mae gave me a furtive glance.
There's more to you than I thought. Dare I say, dangerous.
What's your plan? Mae wagged her finger.
No. I'm sure in time you'll discover that.
She walked up to me.
In the meantime, allow me to heal your wounds.
No, I said. Heal Edward. He needs healing more than I do.
Mae scoffed. I will only heal one of you, not both.
I never asked to be healed, so please heal Edward.
As you wish.
Tamamo no Mae healed Edward by running her porcelain-like fingers across his tattered mouth. She then glanced at me and smiled before vanishing into thin air. While Edward, who had passed out from the shock of having his lips clawed off, started to wake up, I took my shirt, ripped it into pieces, and used them as makeshift bandages around my abdomen. Once Edward regained his senses, and after telling him that the Obia man was defeated, we made our way back onto the Nortec and put Ghoul Island behind us for good. In the weeks that followed, the local Kingston police ruled the deaths of the Lewis children as the work of a madman who was still at large. Bodrick Lewis, who wanted to believe this, admitted to Zakaya that he knew a darker force took the lives of their children. While the couple saw each other through the funerals of their offspring, shortly after, they decided it was best for them to divorce and go their own separate ways. Bodrick moved back to the States, while Zakaya moved in with friends in a nearby town. Edward Lindo wrote a whole story about his adventure with a writer named Rick Salvage. However, the Jamaican Observer would not publish it as his editor saw it as a great fiction. Therefore, Edward decided to turn his story into a novel he titled The Flesh Eater, A True Account of Evil. Ghoul Island was systematically sunk to the bottom of the ocean through controlled explosions performed by Lyle's marine technicians. A holographic dome net was cast over the island so that no diver or submarine could accidentally stumble across it. This agent's wounds were treated by Lyle's medical team in Ocho Rios. Aside from some scarring, this agent should make a full recovery. The encounter with Tamamo no Me raises many questions for this agent. Her motives are still unclear. While she did help this agent defeat Crookshank, this agent has to wonder what she's up to. Of course, this agent would love to say that this yokai is a friend. However, this agent's gut feeling tells him otherwise. As of this report, Patrice Landless, the director of Laos, has authorized a full investigation into Tamamo no Me. How weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. These words are spoken by Shakespeare's Hamlet, whose outlook on life is exhausting and jaded, depressive, but with good reason. His father was murdered, and his mother was quick to marry his uncle. And to top it off, his uncle slash stepfather and mother are both telling him to stop grieving the loss of his father, to cast his knighted color off, and move on, as if a person could choose when to stop mourning the death of a loved one. Shakespeare's Hamlet is a timeless play that puts into question the topic of justice. Can such a thing exist? One can argue that in the play, justice does not, while on the other hand, one can say it does. But in the real world, where life is not a Shakespearean stage production, justice is a fickle thing. Plato believed that justice was a human virtue, that is, it made people consciously responsible for their actions would take in society as a whole into account. But if this agent's time on this harsh rock has taught him anything, it's that justice is found wanting. Thomas Hobbes, in chapter 13 of his book Leviathan, states that humans, in a state of nature, a society without rules or laws, would be distrustful of one another, antisocial, and view others as threats. In this scenario, a person's lifespan would be dramatically shorter because everyone would be trying to kill each other due to fear. And while society does have laws in place to prevent such a fate from occurring, in the end, like Hobbes surmised, these laws are nothing more than artificial chains that force humans to obey what's deemed right. It's the word force here that sends a cold chill down this agent's spine. Forcing humans to do something can only last for so long before they break. Bodrick and Zakaya obeyed the laws of their society, yet their children were murdered underneath the nose of their state. And while this agent was able to track down and bring their children's murderer to a semblance of justice, in the end, was justice served? The innocent lives of their children were still lost. A married couple went their separate ways, and a killer was slaughtered by another, deadlier killer. If there's one thing Hamlet teaches its audience, it's the fact that in order to live in this cold and ruthless world, A person must shed their innocence and replace it with experience. However, that experience is a tainted thing that leads all to ruin. Perhaps what this world needs is more innocence. But how can innocence thrive in an environment filled with so much so-called experience? It's no wonder innocence is a rare commodity, even amongst children. Infants are born with this innocence, but it is quickly drained by the monsters that are itching to drag the world down to the deepest depths of Hades. Nevertheless, this agent still wants to believe that inside every person there resides a faint glimmer of innocence. And, perhaps, one day humanity will find how to light up the dark with the candle of innocence, or extinguish it forever. Either way, this agent has observed, like Hamlet, that there is a divinity that shapes our ends.